Hello, captive friends, and welcome to episode 96 of the Global Captive Podcast, supported by the EY Global Captive Network and hosted by me, Richard Kutcher. We have three brilliant segments lined up for you over the next 40 minutes, including our latest quarterly investments update from London & Capital and a couple of new voices on the pod. One of those new voices is Kirk Watkins, president and founder of Promethean Risk Solutions, to discuss voluntary benefits alongside two of his advisory board members, Gary Osborne and former Vermont regulator David Provost. In the middle of the episode, we will hear from London & Capital Shadrach Khwaza and Rabani Wahab for their latest quarterly investment update. But first, I am joined by Andy Jeckles, co-CEO at IRE, to discuss why he is targeting America's middle market for further expansion and uptake of captive solutions. IRE are captive underwriting specialists based out of London, Bermuda, and Miami. And Andy shares his history in insurance and captives, the IRE proposition, and his views on the captive landscape more broadly for the US middle market. So Andy, great to have you on to the Global Captive Podcast for the first time. Pleasure to be in your offices in, do we call this South London? We're still Central London. We're kind of just down away from London Bridge.
It's Borough.
Yeah, it's Borough. So tell us a bit about your insurance and captive background and when and why you formed IRE.
So I've been involved in insurance for a very long time. I started when I was 13 years old for a local insurance broker, hoovering, making the tea. I'm not going to go through the whole career in detail. Anyway, so I used that job to finance my education and I trained as an underwriter and I moved to a really good Lloyd's syndicate and I got involved in product development. And that's where I first started to come across captives. So I was in Guernsey in 1998, just after when they were launching their protected cell company legislation.
Yep, 1 year later.
Called Risk 98. It's one of those ones where I got a t-shirt and it had the Marsh Risk 98 logo on it, which had stayed in the bottom of the drawer for decades. Anyway, right, so I remember it well. And I was sort of fascinated with that because I think it's got the potential to be revolutionary, you know, to give smaller companies, captives have been really tremendously successful things for the largest companies in the world, and really since, I suppose, the 1950s. And giving that sort of power, that control to much smaller companies, you know, can maybe help them get a lot bigger. I think it could be really empowering for them. I think it could help drive them forward. So I was sort of fascinated. It sort of captured my imagination, but they never really took off. And I get that, and I think the reason they never took off is because there's just too many barriers. You know, if you're, BP or Google or whoever, you know, Amazon, then you've got A ratings, you know, you've got loads and loads of financial resources, you've got real buying power in the market. And that means you can get fronting arrangements, you can interact with the largest companies in the world because you've got a global program and you're going to need them to issue policies all around the world. You know, you've got no problem in terms of interacting with the reinsurance markets, right? You've probably got a rating, you need all the finances you need to get a rating. And if not, you've got no problem providing the collateral that's required. So you've got no problem with the front A-rated paper, policy issuance all done. You've got no problem with reinsurance. You've got no problem with collateral. If you're a small company, you've got a problem with all of that. And so our journey started when my business partner, co-CEO, Rupert Taylor, was working for a Lloyd's syndicate and he was doing some business development activity in the Caribbean. And he came across, he was dealing with the oldest established private bank in the Caribbean. And they were setting up, or interested in setting up, a captive division, because obviously that then fuels funding into their accounts, you know, and that was much more of an international remit. And we started talking about that and we thought there's really something here. And that was the origin of our business. And as we started to peel back all those layers, what you realise is that in the mid-market, what you're left with is what's essentially enterprise risk, you know, slightly esoteric risk, not true commercial P&C, things that don't require an A rating, things where you can take all the risk yourself and they don't require reinsurance. So obviously there's no collateral provision because there's no front, no reinsurer. And so, you know, as we sort of got into it, we thought, do you know what, there's people are taking really substantial risks here. It sounds to us like there should be reinsurance involved, and why aren't they underwriting, you know, the stuff that we recognize, you know, general liability, if it states terminology, or, you know, their commercial property, or even their workers' comp and auto, the things that they have to buy, the things where they're spending hundreds of thousands or sometimes millions of dollars on insurance premiums. Why aren't companies that have got the wherewithal to do this doing it? And so we started to work out the solution, which is now called Repaid.
Fantastic. So you've started to touch there, obviously, on the opportunity you see in the middle market, America's middle market, which is what we're focusing on in this discussion. What then is the kind of the opportunity that you see to provide Repaid to this group? Because we know about enterprise risk captures, as some people call them, or, you know, smaller captures, the ones that make 85 on B tax selection or not. You know, they don't have to be doing that, but we're talking about that smaller captive level, probably in the kind of 2 million.
Yeah, we call them high performing mid market
companies. All right, that's another high performing mid market companies that should potentially own a captive.
Yeah.
So what's the kind of, you know, lots of people trying to sell these people captives in the US. So what is it you're trying to want to provide to them? And
I think for us, when we started, we had much more international outlook. We were thinking we're going to go for world domination.
Yeah.
You know, as you do when you're in a startup phase. But what we found was culturally, the US is much more, a much greater stage of readiness. You know, they're much more acceptance of this idea of taking risk, earning reward. In order to answer your question, I think what you've got to do is step into the shoes, if you like, the mindset of the buyer. So the reason we call them high performing mid-market is because we're targeting clients with a reasonable insurance spend, a minimum of $250,000 per line of business that we do.
And real insurance spend as well.
Real, so property, general liability, workers' comp, auto, commercial auto. And the clients with loss ratios of less than 40%, our average is 20%. So we're really talking best of the best. So if you imagine you're spending $1 million in insurance premiums and your claims are $200,000 a year, what you're doing is you're thinking, my insurance company is either making an absolute fortune out of me, $800,000 profit, and I know that actually they're not making that money because they've got to pay for the commission, let alone anything else, and their costs and expenses, and there's a difference between, you know, loss ratio and combined operating ratio, but that's not the headline that any client sees. What they're seeing is that company is making a huge amount of money out of me, and they're either making a fortune or they're spending my money on somebody else's claims. Oh. If you drop that into the current market, particularly property wise, where we're looking like we're in a sustained hard market with rates increasing significantly over a period of time, where it's not uncommon to find clients getting price rises of 20 or 30%, oh, right? The clients are finding that pretty hard to take. And so what they think is, if I could take that risk myself, I would. And there's the opportunity. All you've got to do is solve the problem with fronting, the problem with collateral, and a problem with reinsurance. So we did that with Repaid by operating it on a, looking at it as a portfolio.
So a portfolio of multiple clients?
Yeah,
so we,
not so much a group captive approach, but the way we do it is we, reinsure our insurer partners. So we work with US domestic A-rated insurers, Fortegra, PMA, and we give them one single reinsurance contract. So we provide them with a one single point of collateral.
Yeah.
And we manage all the complexity behind the scenes for them. So what our reinsurance company is doing in Bermuda is reinsuring out to captives that are owned typically by the owners of the insured business that we're insuring at the front end. So all that complexity, we're amalgamating for our insurers, effectively a portfolio of clients, so we handle all that distribution, and they're getting a single contract, which means we can now deal with them using commercial underwriting practices, commercial underwriting models. We interact with ISO, the largest insurance pricing database in the world. We pull that all into a proprietary model that we've agreed with insurers, so we're operating under varying degrees of delegated authority depending on their line of business. All that complexity gets managed both for our insurer partners and for the client. So what the client gets, you know, insurer gets one contract, that all makes sense. They get fantastic risk selection. Not that we're primarily like driving that. I mean, it's really driven by a process of self-selection, because no client is going to seek to underwrite and take risk, their own risk, if they think they're going to make a loss. Yeah. So we only deal with, that's why we can deal with clients with very, very low loss ratios, because we haven't got those pressures that are available in the open market where the broking community are doing their job and getting every risk placed.
And is every client then, they have their own vehicle, which is their own, just purely their own risk? Is there pooling involved, or kind of?
There is pooling involved. Yeah. So every client takes their own risk, and they take an element of risk from other participants in the repay program, and they need that to be an insurance company. I think it's quite an interesting thing when people talk about risk pooling, because they often see it as a sort of a threat, you know, like everyone else is going to combine and they're all going to make a load of losses and that's going to cost me a fortune. But of course, pooling works the opposite way. What it does is when you've got infrequent large losses, it irons those out and produces quite a low loss ratio. The actual threat of volatility doesn't come from everyone else. It comes from you, you know, your own risk. And we try to give clients as much of their own risk as possible. So they take, in our program as it stands at the moment, 70% of their risk is their own direct risk that comes to them on a reinsurance fact contract.
The kind of enterprise risk capture space in the US is been pretty crowded, pretty busy marketplace the last, let's say, 15, 20 years, maybe even in longer than that. And, you know, not without its problems and, you know, bad actors, lots of good actors as well. How do you kind of assess the landscape that you're kind of taking part in? And I imagine there's lots of people that you do business with in that market, probably some people in that market you probably don't want to do business with. So, like, how do you assess that broad landscape in that kind of enterprise risk capture space in the US, with all the noise around 8-foot-on-B and all that stuff around it?
Well, we interact with lots of captive managers, and I think they
you're
both
not captive managers,
we don't do any captive management. We're insurance and reinsurance underwriters, that's it, and we only do commercial P&C risk. So the captive managers we're interacting with don't really do much of that outside of our program. Typically they can do things like deductible buyback policies and those sorts of things, but I mean, it's a quite well-known sector, that enterprise risk. So the way I see it, breaks down into sort of three groups, right? You've got a bunch of captive managers who are strongly advising their clients to take 831A tax elections. And there are some distinct advantages with that. And there are also some disadvantages to that, because there's an awful lot to deal with when you're a small startup captive. You've got another bunch of clients who are really digging their heels in around the 831B tax election and overtly pursuing an agenda where they are doing best practice in the industry, and they think that that tax election should be applied in a proper and fair way by all parties. And they're pursuing an agenda that sort of says these things are right, these things are wrong. And I think most of those would welcome guidance about, you know, what good looks like, you know, what good practice looks like.
From the government, from the IRS.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. And I think if they got that, they'd be very happy to follow that. Everybody wants to play by those rules. But there are two distinct groups, really. Those that are avoiding 831Bs, pursuing 831As, and those that are saying 831Bs is the tax selection that's designed for these sorts of clients.
Yeah, should be utilised.
And then I think you've probably got another group who are perhaps don't pursue best practice. And I think that's where the IRS is cracking down.
Yeah.
And I personally, my impression, and we do a lot of due diligence on our captive managers to make sure that they are, if you like, good actors in the industry. But I think there is a diminishing number, vastly diminishing number of those sorts of bad actors. And I think there's a lot more good practice.
Yeah. And I think those bad actors, they might be a diminishing number, but they're also a lot quieter, I think, than they were maybe 5 years ago when they were shouting about some of the things that they were doing without maybe thought much of the consequence.
It's quite an interesting space, though, because from our perspective is we're only doing real insurance, commercial insurance.
Yeah.
That you're interacting with commercial insurance carriers. I mean, there's real risk.
Yeah.
You know, I don't want to step too much into that area, but from our perspective, what we do is indisputably insurance.
Yeah, and that's why I kind of, you know, it's interesting you mentioned general liability, auto, workers' comp, property, like these are all legitimate insurance programs.
Mainstream, pillars of any insurance program.
There's real risk there. And track records of losses and claims and that kind of stuff. So just broadly, I think you've kind of touched on it a bit earlier, but in terms of what is holding back that wider adoption of captive utilization in America's middle market, it kind of feels strange to ask that because, you know, America's middle market is the middle market which has adopted captives the most. But you obviously think there's still plenty of room to grow there, and there's still plenty of companies out there that should be considering a kind of captive approach. So why, as a fellow Brit sat here in London, we're talking about America's middle market, why is that area so much of interest in you, and what is that, what are those hurdles which have been kind of holding back that utilization?
Whether I'm a Brit or not, I think the US market is extremely attractive because they're culturally attuned to taking risk, seeking reward. And so it feels to me that they're the most developed marketplace and they're ready. So you're beyond the innovator, early adopters, right? And I think the vanguard in terms of doing commercial risk in that space, in the captive space, have been group captives. I think they've been tremendously successful, and they are really very, very good tools, programs for people to join. They've been very successful in workers' comp and auto marketplaces, relatively mature, and they've saved a lot of people a lot of money and helped them drive good practice in the industry. And I think that they were the vanguard for me in the commercial risk space. So what we're about is giving people much more individual power. I think if you're taking your own risk rather than in a group captive and you have your own captive vehicle, you can choose to have much more autonomy, much more control, much more direction. You've got much more flexibility. You know, the decision making becomes yours. And also, if you're taking much more of your own risk, the impact of your actions in your operating business and how you control risk, mitigate claims, is directly impacting you and the profit you earn. You can also decide things like how that's invested within the investment guidelines of your captive, and when you take that profit. You've not got a situation where you have to take a dividend at the end of every year. That's what we want. We want our clients to be thinking about their risk, their reward. And we think that's where the true alignment of interest comes from. And so the reason I think the market hasn't gone any further is because there hasn't really been those products out there that can empower the clients individually to take their captives. And I think that's where we come in. And that's why we see such a big opportunity. I think it's a market where there is demand, where they're ready. Our challenge is to educate them that our product and actually the captives in general are tools that many, many, many more organisations could use.
Well, thank you to Andy Jeckles for joining me on the pod, and I thought it was really good to get some new insights into captive solutions for the US middle market. I expect we'll be hearing more from Andy and Irie in the coming months. Next up, let's get our quarterly investments update from London and Capital with Shadrach Kwasi, Executive Director, and Rabani Wahab, Senior Fixed Income Fund Manager.
Rabani, thank you for taking the time to speak to us today. I think a good place to start would be highlights of what's happened over the last quarter from an investment and macroeconomic perspective, and would be good to get your view on that.
Yeah, it's been a really very interesting last 3 months. It's been full of challenges for bond markets, and more recently, a little bit more challenging for equity markets as well. One of the main themes was continued tough talk from central bankers, primarily from the US Federal Reserve, but then similar sort of language was adopted by the European Central Bank. And this effectively was saying that we're going to keep rates high for a long, long time until the battle against inflation has been won. And what that did was that effectively took its strain on government bond deals, particularly long-dated government bond deals, which started to get used to a world of flatlining interest rates without much movements lower or higher. And bond deals did move higher. 10-year Treasury bond deals, which is one of the benchmark markets for all asset classes, it did pop its head above 5%, which is the highest level we've seen for quite a few decades, actually. And that's one of the things which undermined some of the other asset classes. Equities had a bit of a poor run over the last 3 months. But then I think, you know, that's really been strewn with what's been happening on the central bank side. But then in terms of economic activity, the broad message is that the US is confounding a lot of analysts in that it's still relatively buoyant as far as economic activity is concerned. And the fall in employment, which many of us had expected at this point in the economic cycle, hasn't really turned up. And that's the reason why I think a lot of central banks remain a little bit concerned. And that's the reason why markets have been a little bit more nervous and a little bit more worried about where interest rates will be over the course of the next few quarters.
Thinking about it from a sort of global perspective, are there any particular regions where you feel that there's more hope from an economic perspective or otherwise?
Yeah, you know, I think the US, of course, is, if you like, the strongest of all the economies that we've seen over the not just the last 3 months, but then certainly over the last 12 months or so. There are, however, not all that many which can boast, if you like, the sort of numbers that we've seen in the US. And I guess no particular order, the German economy has been a source of concern for us, and I'm sure it's going to be a source of concern for the European Central Bank, because that's been, if you like, the one very large economy which has been disappointing from many, many angles. Its trade volumes to the rest of the world has fallen markedly, and that, as a consequence, has had its toll on domestic activity and, of course, Eurozone activity, because it is by far the largest of all the Eurozone nations, and the whole of the ex-German European community relies a lot on Germany to provide that level of demand throughout that zone. So that's a source of concern. The other source of concern is the Chinese economy, which is still struggling to recover from its recent economic slump, and largely due to quite a big fall in exports, but then domestic activity has been dogged by the housing crisis. And the housing crisis has led to quite a few credit events domestically. It's not really been exported abroad, but then two of the very large companies, Evergrande and Country Garden, have both entered into default, which is really quite a big negative for the Chinese economy. So in answer to your question, Shadrach, it's really just been the US economy, which has been the standout, has been, if you like, the good performers, little signs of recovery in the other major economies that we follow.
I guess one of the other things that I've read about quite a lot in the press is interest rates and inflation and where these are going and whether or not they've peaked. What are your views on interest rates and inflation, and where do you think they're headed?
Well, I think the most important thing for the bond markets and also therefore for the other risk markets such as equities is at what stage will the central banks feel that their task against inflation is being won? And even though most of the commentary that comes out from the likes of the Federal Reserve, the Bank of England, and the European Central Bank, we hear that they're still not ready to pull the trigger to talk about lower rates. I think the most important message that we're getting is that we're unlikely to have any further rate increases. And one of the reasons for that is because they are looking at the pace of economic activity, and the pace of economic activity, certainly in the non-US world, is starting to probably just worry them a little bit. And, you know, the forecast that we have for the first quarter of next year and the second quarter of next year is it's going to be pretty anemic growth, not just in the European economies, but then on a global basis. I don't know whether we're looking for a deep recession, but then certainly recessions in Europe and the UK are certainly possible. In the US, we think that it's likely to see a much lower path of economic growth in the first half of next year. So the answer to your point, Shadrach, is that, you know, as far as interest rates are concerned, we think as we start calendar 2024, there's going to be a much greater precedence for the central banks to start to think about lowering rates. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that we're going to be seeing 2% rates, 2% inflation levels by the end of the first half, but then it's the direction of inflation which is the most important. And the risk that I think the global economy faces is if rates are kept too high for too long, we will have an entrenched recession, not just in individual countries, but on a global basis. So we're linking, if you like, the path of inflation with where we think interest rates are going to go. And we think that certainly by the middle of next year, there's going to be a much stronger case for lower rates going forward.
That is very interesting. Lower rates, huh? You know, I'm looking forward to that, given I need to remortgage at some point. So I guess the obvious question here for our captive listeners is, what does all this mean for captive insurance assets?
Well, you know, it's been a bit of a tough time for fixed income markets. As we know, it's been for the best part of 2 years, bond yields have been rising in reaction to inflation doing what it's done. And of course, that's led to a lot of confusion as to, you know, how much interest rates would need to go up. So where we are right now on in the world of fixed income is we're actually starting to compete in the world of fixed income against valuations from other competing asset classes, such as equities. And, you know, there's lots of statistics which we can refer to. But then when we see, if you like, government bond yields at or around about 5% in the US and similar levels, margin lower in the UK, and around about 3 to 3.5 to 4% in the Eurozone. These are levels which we haven't really seen for decades. And that's one thing which is going to be most important for going forward. So in terms of where insurers' assets should be invested, the yield on most of the high-grade corporate bond indices in all these regions that we've been discussing are actually higher than the dividend yields offered by the equity markets. And this is something which we haven't seen for a long, long time. And so from that perspective, what we're doing for all the captive relationships that we have is we're not going to be underweight duration compared to the liabilities within the fixed income portfolio. And I think the big challenge for equity markets is if there's going to be, if you like, a protracted slowdown in economic growth, whether that's going to be disturbing the earnings outlook for next year and beyond. So our view is to be not only at least at neutral duration within the fixed income portfolio, but then there's a strong case to be above normal allocation to fixed income for the next 6 months at least, in order for capturing, if you like, some of those longer dated yields and locking into them rather than staying defensive, as many investors have been over the course of the last couple of years.
What about sort of cash and deposits and things of that nature? Because we are aware a lot of captive insurers sort of favor the holding them in the bank or similar type of securities. What's your view on those, given the outlook for interest rates and the economy?
I think, you know, cash has been a tremendous place to have been parked in for certainly the last year and a half. And even though nominally a year and a half ago, we weren't getting that much in terms of yield, of course, over the course of the last year or so, it's been a very, very attractive source of return. And now I think we're in the phase where, you know, that overweight, which we suspect many captive insurers and other global investors have been in, the overweight to cash, I think there's quite a strong case for those cash levels to be reduced somewhat and to just extend up the yield curve. And by that, we're not going gung-ho into 30-year maturities, but then given the world that we think we might see in 2024 and beyond, this is the right time to deploy some of that cash into locking in some of the yields which are offered by not just government bonds, but then very high-grade fixed income bonds. Not the right time for us to go into high yield because, you know, when there's going to be question marks over the economic growth prospects for next year, high yield might suffer somewhat. But then there's a very strong case, in our opinion, to deploy some of that cash into those high grade investment grade fixed income assets.
Thank you, Rabbani. That's been really helpful and really insightful. Thank you for your time and have a good day.
Thank you very much, Adrian.
Great to get that regular insights and analysis from Shadrach and Rabbani. Okay, last but certainly by no means least, we welcome Kirk Watkins onto the pod for the first time. Kirk is well known to me and will be known to many in the US captive market and has specialized in voluntary benefits and affinity programs. He went independent last year, founding Promethean Risk Solutions, and so I caught up with him while at VCIA in August. Kirk is joined in this discussion by two of his advisory board members and regulars on the pod, Gary Osborne and former Vermont regulator David Provost. So Kirk, great to have you onto the Global Captive podcast for the first time, I believe. Over a year ago, you set up Promethean Risk. Yeah. So tell us a bit about Promethean Risk and what you're doing.
Thank you very much, Richard. Promethean Risk Solutions focuses on third-party programs for employees, tenants, students, association members, etc. And, you know, what we do is we build profitable programs and turn your captive into a profit center.
And it's been, you know, something we've talked about. Obviously, you and I have talked about it many times over the past. And just in general, obviously, third-party risk is an increasingly hot topic in the industry. There are lots of statistics out there in terms of more third-party risk going into captives. What is it that Promethean is doing to kind of support that structure to actually allow captives to start to dabble in third-party profitable business?
I think one of the unique things we do is we find programs that maybe employers are already offering to their employees, like voluntary benefits, or maybe real estate financing firms are offering to their tenants, and we increase the coverage and reduce the premium for the policyholders and make it a very profitable program for the participating company.
Because you're not a captive manager yourself, right? So what's your role in kind of structuring the program and administering it?
Well, what we do is we put the programs together. We work with the front. We have some key fronts, partner fronts that we work with already. We do joint underwriting with the carrier and put together the customer and the whole, the back end of it. So at the end of the day, what we're looking to do is provide the client with a turnkey solution that's built.
And in terms of the types of companies or organizations that you want to work with and targeting to work with, what, I mean, I think it's a wide range, right, of types of companies, but where can these, what types of companies do you think that these types of programs are kind of most suitable for or work for?
So our target is employers with over 1,000 employees or PEOs, et cetera. Real estate firms with over 5,000 apartments or associations with over 50,000 members, and we'll build the programs for them.
And they could be in any kind of sector, industry?
Absolutely.
Cool. We've got next to you a couple of your associates, I believe, on your advisory board. So we've got Gary Osborne, who should be well known to listeners, and David Provost, from formerly from the state of Vermont. You've dragged him out of retirement to be, I think, involved here. So Gary, what's interesting to you about this proposition from Promethean, and why did you want to get involved?
Well, Kirk had actually approached me about 4 years ago when he was with a former employer, and it was, the program was very appealing. And so when he got out on his own, I was like, you're now in a position where you are appealing to a much broader range of captive owners, managers. So literally at this point, I said I'd be extremely interested in being the captive manager for you, and being my mostly independent role, I felt that was probably beneficial to Kirk. But also, every single client I've mentioned this to you, I've mentioned this program to you, has wanted a call with Kirk. From my own parent company, to churches, to real estate clients, which I've got a lot of, I've all had calls. We've probably had 15 calls already with my clients. So I can sort of proof of the pudding in that this is something people definitely want to at least kick the tires on. I mean, the vast majority of them have asked for more information. Sometimes we're running into the problem that they're on a 3-year deal with somebody, and so it might be 25 before we do this. But nobody, absolutely nobody, has said, oh, no interest. So this is just something that people are like, wow, this is just something no one's ever really brought to us. And you probably heard this from Kurt before, but the unique thing is, this is a pool, but people don't get scared of it being a pool, because he explains it very well, that the pool is absolutely necessary. Because people are like, why do I have to go through your captive? And with a quick explanation, and David is the regulator, can probably give you a little bit more on that front, but the pooling is actually very, very important, because it's going to give you smoother results, but it also deals with ERISA and DOL issues. And maybe David, that might be something you jump in with, but that's a very important thing that Kirk solved that hadn't been solved before he did this.
And Dave, we'll come back to the pool and to the captive management side as well in a second, but Dave, how have you been dragged out of retirement to be involved here? Well,
Kirk actually asked me before I had finished retiring at last year's conference, and he just asked me to be on an advisory board, and so I said, sure, this is an interesting project. I like looking at things like this, and so I've been, you know, reading the contracts, reading the applications, and helping just try to make sure that it would fit with what most regulators would want to see. And it really does. You know, one of the things that regulators might say with a captive, you had me at fronted. These are all fronted programs. So the business is regulated up front by traditional regulators. The fronting carriers have to cede to the captive and get credit for reinsurance based on their rules that are set by their regulators. And then the captive can keep the results, or like Kerr said, retrocede it to your captive. And so it's fairly simple from a regulator's point of view. Again, Kirk deals with the DOL and ERISA issues, so I can just look at the captive regulatory issues. And as a former regulator, these are programs that I would have approved. As long as there's some connection between the captive owner and the business being generated, whether it's tenants or employees or former employees, even as long as you can make that captive connection, most regulators are going to have very few issues with this kind of a program. It's pretty simple.
And I believe as well it can work if you're a company that doesn't already have a captive. That's the whole point of having the cell company, right? Is the cell can be used as kind of the captive part of the program for that client.
The series law allows for a profit sharing participation, so that's one of the reasons why the series is being used, because it gives Kirk the opportunity to see somebody. He's told me before that sometimes this is a great idea, but I've got to form an insurance company. I've got to form an owner of an insurance company. In this case, now with the cell, the series cell, we do not need to actually form an owner of an insurance company. So that can simplify. HR is not often as familiar with captives as the P&C side of the world. So this is, we think that's another important fact that will increase the willingness to participate.
So Gary touched upon the pool, Kirk. So why is the pool so important as part of your structure and your offering to clients?
Well, when we talk specifically about voluntary benefits, voluntary ERISA benefits, supplemental medical, legal insurance, those benefits are governed under ERISA, the government retirement plan here in the United States, and the Department of Labor. So it's a prohibited transaction. If I wanted to reinsure those voluntary benefits in my own captive, it'd be a prohibitive transaction. The DOL looks at that as the fox watching the hen house because they set the premium for the employees and the coverage, etc. So by pooling it and retroceding it out, you're getting a very small portion of your own risk because it's ceded, and in the case of the captive and the employer, they're not directly involved in the underwriter choosing the benefit levels or the premium.
Well, obviously, the way you sell it, it sounds like a no-brainer, right? It sounds like every captive should be doing this. Every large company should be thinking about having these programs. What has been the barrier in the past, or what has been the hard sell, which means we don't see every captive already doing this kind of thing?
I think most risk managers don't work directly with HR and benefits, if we're talking about voluntary benefits. So at the previous employer we was at, we focused primarily on voluntary benefits. In this case, where we're dealing with tenant programs, church programs, etc., we're working directly with the risk managers who are working with marketing, etc. So I think that's the big difference. And the number one captive, which actually was a Vermont captive a few years ago that was the first one to be approved to do this, their captive manager was here and was telling a story. He moved to a new company and had his comp and benefits director with him. And he said, here's how it went down. Kirk flew out. We said, we already like this. We like this idea. Just tell us what the catch is and we'll do it. I said, what do you mean? What's the catch? Well, there's got to be a catch because the employees benefit, the captive benefits, and the carrier gets a new client. What's the catch? And I think the issue is we're all used to insurance products where kind of somebody gets the short end of the straw. I have lots of claims. I love my insurance company, my coverage. I don't have any claims, and I write a big check. I'm not happy. But in this case, you know, the employees get reduced, or the policyholders get reduced premium, increased coverage. It's usually returns 15 to 20% in profits. And the carriers get, since we only work with large market accounts, get a large market that they're providing services to.
Dave, from your experience as a regulator previously, did you see many of these programs, these types of programs come across your desk? Did you start to see an increase in this kind of thing in the last few years?
We saw a few, but like Kirk said, one of the problems would be that HR and risk management didn't always talk. Hmm. So what we saw when we did see it was that it was a successful conversation between the risk manager and HR, usually with the risk manager saying, you get your programs, we're just taking care of the financing of it. So you, HR, can design the programs and get what you want. We'll put it through our captive and take care of the financing. And those deals always worked out well.
And I think to clarify that, Richard, is when we speak predominantly about voluntary benefits, they're the benefits that are 100% paid for by the employees. The employer doesn't participate in paying the premium at all. So typically, their HR kind of, let's call them nice to have benefits, ancillary on top of the company provided benefits. And so risk and finance and C-suite are typically not involved in those. And that, quite frankly, is the reason that the premiums and the loss ratios are typically where they are. A lot of those programs only have loss ratios at 25 to 30%. And that's why we're able to significantly decrease the premium and increase the coverage to the employees.
Because the risk manager would know that's too low a loss ratio. Somebody's making too much money here.
Well, exactly. And we talk about loss ratios a lot, right, at the moment in the scrutiny of captives. And there's some interesting opinions out there on things.
The independence of this new program is a massive advantage too, in that other people are, the acceptability of this program now is dramatically increased.
I mean, we'll partner with any captive manager, consultant, broker, and provide them, you know, opportunities to present their client with new profitable programs.
Well, thank you to Kirk, Gary, and Dave, and good luck to them in that venture. And to all of our guests in this episode, Shadrack and Rabani at London and Capital, and Andy Jeckles at IRE, who we heard from at the start. As ever, to keep up with all goings-on in the global captive insurance market, make sure you are visiting captiveintelligence.io and signed up to our twice-weekly newsletter. We only send you the news, which is highly relevant to your work in the captive market, and we try and provide our own analysis and insight along the way as well. There are links in the episode show notes. In the meantime, stay safe, stay well, and see you next time, captives.